Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you all for being here, so many of you, on an afternoon, and so many footnotes collected in one place. A few housekeeping rules. One is telephones. You heard mine ring a few minutes ago. Please put your phone on silent. If you need to take a call, walk out into the hallway down the steps, and you can do a call there. If you need Wi-Fi, this is the main dining room, and the secret code word is computer. So please take care of your phones now and check them and get that done. Upcoming events on the 29th, Lawrence Brom, some of you will know him from his column that used to appear quite often, Does China Mean Business on Cleaning Up the Environment? That will be on the 29th, so please look forward to that. Turning to today, what next for Hong Kong global perspectives on free expression? Today, Pan American is going to be releasing its report. We'll find out what that is all about. It certainly comes at a timely moment in Hong Kong. I'm going to just run through the names and ask each person to hold up their hands quickly in no particular order. Peter Godwin, who's the president of Pan. Suzanne Nossel, who's the executive director of Pan. Art Spiegelman, the Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist, and Susan Orleone from The New Yorker. And they can tell you more about themselves later. And I think we should more or less get right to it. So I'm going to just begin by turning it over to Peter Godwin to tell us a little bit, first of all, about Penn, and then Suzanne Nossel will tell us more about the report. Peter.
This. Can you hear me? Oh, amazing. Hello, everybody. I'm Peter Godwin. I'm still Peter Godwin. I'm currently the president of Pan American Center, which is the largest of the Pan International groupings. We have more than 100 around the world. Pan was started more than 90 years ago in London by the likes of H.G. Wells, George Bernard Shaw, John Galsworthy, Conrad. And it was started with the idea of bringing down barriers to free expression. This was in the dark days after World War II. Pan American Center has more than 3,500 members. We host a Pan World Voices Festival. We do a prison writing program, a translation program, various literary awards, and our membership includes novelists, playwrights, editors, poets, journalists, translators, publishers, and agents. We are here in the region, this little, I don't really want to call it a delegation, because we don't really ride like that at Penn. I have to say, after nearly 3 years of being Penn president, it's trying to get to coordinate writers to doing anything at all is like herding cats. But we have been in the region. We've just come back from a nearly week-long trip to Beijing, where we just wanted to really take the temperature of free expression there, and then on the way back, have a look at Hong Kong. But this report was obviously researched and prepared in advance of that. So I want to turn over to Suzanne Nossel, who's our Pen Executive Director, Pen American Center's Executive Director, to tell you more about the report itself.
Thanks very much, Peter, and thanks to everybody for being here and to the Foreign Correspondents Club for hosting us for this meeting. The genesis of this report predated Occupy. We were concerned about developments in relation to free expression in Hong Kong going back a year or so. In a sense, it feels strange to release the report here because most of you in the audience know more about the situation for free expression in Hong Kong than we do. And we learned a lot of what we do know from people that we interviewed, including some people who are here in this room and many others who spoke to us, most of them off the record, but some are quoted in the report. And if you haven't seen a copy of the report, there are still more lying on the table near the entrance here. But we thought it was important to do this report to spotlight these issues really for the rest of the world. The world looks at Hong Kong as a beacon and a bulwark for free expression in the region, as well as such a crucial portal for reporting on mainland China. And, you know, I think this building really tells the story of the history of reporting and journalism and press freedom in Hong Kong in many ways. And you could see the photos around the room and around the building that attest to that very long and rich tradition. And it was troubling to us to see that tradition put at risk, and we felt it was a story that needed to be put together and told to the world. And the story will be reported. It's obviously been told in pieces here in Hong Kong and in the international media, but we've tried to pull it together and raise attention. I would say sending an early warning bell out about our concerns and hopefully drawing attention in ways that lead to mobilization to defend press freedom here in Hong Kong. And the report is covered in the New York Times, I guess Friday's edition, and that story is already up online and you can see it. I want to say that as an organization, we have a very long history of work in China, including with a partner organization, the Independent Chinese Pen Center, whose president was Liu Xiaobo. But we've not had a long history of work on Hong Kong. So we come to this, in a sense, not as experts, but as free expression, kind of global generalists. We've done reports on free expression issues over the last year in Turkey, in Honduras. We do a lot of work also on free expression concerns in the United States, including two reports on the impact of NSA dragnet surveillance and the ways in which that's led to self-censorship for writers both in the United States and around the world. So we train a sharp eye on our own government, trying to hold them accountable for upholding their human rights and free expression obligations. And we also train our sights on the rest of the world. I want to talk briefly about the findings in the report and touch on some of the recommendations that we've made, and we'll then turn the floor open to all of you for questions and discussion about the report itself and about the trip that we've taken, the four of us and our group from Penn here in Hong Kong as well as in Beijing. So just to sketch out briefly our report and the issues that we cover. We begin with an outline simply of Hong Kong's free expression obligations under the Basic Law and under international human rights law, which are pretty clear. Hong Kong residents shall have freedom of speech, of the press, and of publication, it says in Article 27. And Article 16 of the Bill of Rights Ordinance quotes directly from Article 19 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which is the foundational provision in international human rights law. And the way it's been interpreted is that there are certain valid grounds for infringements on press freedom, but that one of them is not an effort by a government to suppress criticism and dissent. So with that foundation, we look at several categories of infringement that together sort of form a pattern. And the first is physical assaults on journalists, where we document 11 reported cases of assaults between the middle of 2012 and the middle of 13, and an additional six over the next year, between mid-2013 and mid-2014. And these are cases that I know are all familiar to those in this room. The case of Kevin Lau, probably the most high profile, but not the only one. The case of the Hong Kong Morning News Media Group attacks and others. We also look at cases of press freedom infringements during the Occupy protests themselves. And many of these were cases of unidentified assailants attacking journalists covering the protests and altercations that happened between anti-Occupy protesters and media trying to cover the work of the movement. We also look at a number of cases of Hong Kong police infringing on the press's ability to do their job in relation to covering the protests. And I would say the protests obviously were covered incredibly widely, and I think many journalists felt that they had a relatively free hand in moving around. But there are some notable cases of police who seem not to recognize their own obligations when a journalist brought forward their press card, identified themselves as a member of the media, but was nonetheless pushed away or sprayed with pepper spray. And this is not entirely unusual. We did a report last fall on similar pattern of violations and more violations that took place in Ferguson, Missouri, when police there were trying to contain protests and over 50 instances interfered with the rights of journalists and members of the media who are covering the protests. But it's a global issue that we see of police often being both ill-informed about their obligations in relation to press freedom and poorly trained on how to uphold those requirements. We also look in the report at threats to free expression online, and particularly the use of Section 161 of the Crimes Ordinance to target individuals who used social media platforms and the internet to mobilize, to call people to come forward and out onto the streets. And what has happened is that individuals, in some cases, posting anonymously, their identities were uncovered, presumably through the cooperation of internet service providers and platforms, and individuals were arrested for those posts and comments on their own feeds. And this represents, in our view, an infringement on internet freedom and a misuse of this longstanding provision, 161, that was never intended to be used in this way and was created and established as a ordinance to regulate true cyber crime and fraud, but instead is being used to shrink the zone of free expression online. We also document a pattern of cyber attacks, particularly during the protests, major websites, including Apple Daily, being systematically targeted, taken down for the count at crucial periods, as well as the Hong Kong University POP website that was targeted by what we have determined through experts seems to be a pretty comprehensive and systematic attack. We also look at a pattern of the removal of media figures and journalists known for their independence and for their sometimes critical views, as well as instances of individual articles and columns being censored or withdrawn or pressure put upon journalists in relation to posts and messages and reporting that was seen as politically sensitive or unfriendly. And most disturbingly, individuals being removed from their jobs on grounds that their colleagues saw as clearly politically motivated. And then finally, we look at politically motivated economic pressures being placed on Hong Kong-based publications and the pattern of withdrawal of advertising support from some publications. We added to the report just over the last couple of days the very distressing comments made by the chief executive in relation to the undergrad student newspaper. And I know everybody's familiar with those remarks, but certainly they add another very kind of brazen example of the kind of approach that seems to be at work here. And kind of when you, I think if you read the report, you look across this pattern of very different incidents, any one of which in of itself might be the kind of thing that you would see in free countries around the world, the pattern coalescing with its many dimensions really does give the sense of kind of clouds amassing on the horizon and a bastion of free expression that is at risk. We direct our recommendations at the end of the report in three directions. The first set to the government of Hong Kong, urging the prompt and thorough investigation of all reports of attacks on journalists and media personnel and holding accountable those responsible. And we document in the report just the paucity of information about these investigations, in some cases very light penalties being imposed, and in many cases the investigations not really seeming to go very far. We talk about the issue of police training in relation to protests, We talk about online and internet freedom and cite the UN Human Rights Council's resolution detailing states' obligations in that regard. We also urge more appropriate use and accountability and transparency in relation to Section 161. In terms of the international community, what we're really urging is a much more active and focused monitoring effort directed at Hong Kong's compliance with its international and domestic free expression obligations, as well as mobilization of those, including the UN Special Rapporteur on Free Expression, who are empowered to investigate and report and engage with relevant authorities. We talk about the importance of foreign governments raising their concerns bilaterally in Hong Kong and in Beijing. And we talk about the obligation of international organizations, including institutions and businesses, not to allow their engagement here to become politicized in ways that interfere with free expression. And then finally, to kind of our sister organizations in the media freedom and human rights fields, we think it's time that a directed lens be trained on Hong Kong. Hong Kong has to be pulled out in all of the reporting that we do, documenting patterns of concern with respect to free expression, internet freedom. Hong Kong is in a very unique and we think somewhat perilous situation and warrants a heightened level of attention and scrutiny to try to make sure that this pattern does not intensify and that the rights that Hong Kongers have enjoyed for so long are upheld and protected. So I think with that, I'll stop. Thank you very much, Francis.
Thank you very much, Suzanne. Let me point out that there's still two seats up in front. If there's anybody in the back who doesn't have a seat, we do have two here. I'd like to point out also as well that everything that is said here is recorded and we put it on YouTube. So if you ask questions, please speak clearly into the microphone and identify yourself. And one piece of housekeeping I forgot, which is apropos Suzanne's comments, is that today is the last official day for getting your applications in for the Human Rights Press Awards. So those of you who are thinking of it or know somebody who's thinking of getting the awards in, you don't have much time. I'm going to exercise the prerogative of the chair here and just sort of ask anybody who wants to chip in, Suzanne or anybody else, did you have an impression of Hong Kong before you came? And if not, if so, what is your impression now as you go away?
I think the first thing to say, and I'm not just saying this to try and ingratiate myself to many of the people who are here, although that would be good too, is that the story was covered, the Occupy Central, and the story was covered very well and broadly, and I think there was a Western awareness in countries like America, which can be famously insular and parochial itself. It did break through the sort of penumbra of lack of interest in foreign things. So there was an awareness, especially of the Occupy Center. Before that, I think it's true to say, in America in particular, Hong Kong, in a sense, suffers from being seen almost exclusively through the lens of China, the greater China, that the market in China is so enormous, and that China is such a big country as a whole, that Hong Kong is often seen only as a kind of footnote. The situation here, the unique situation here. I think that that, you know, for us, we've, as I said earlier, and in a second, if I may, would like to introduce my two colleagues here. And in fact, what I should probably do just for now is introduce myself. Other than being President of Penn, I'm a human rights lawyer originally, and I was born and brought up in Africa, and myself a foreign correspondent for many years in Africa and Eastern Europe and various places for the London Sunday Times and the BBC. And perhaps what I'll just do now, if I have the chance, is to ask Art Spiegelman and Susan Orlean to just introduce themselves, as they were part of this delegation. As I said, we've spent 5 or 6 days in Beijing before coming to Hong Kong.
So can I pass that to Susan?
Sure you can. This is a...
Well, good afternoon. I'm Susan Orlean. I'm a staff writer at The New Yorker, an author of a number of books, including a few that have been translated into Chinese and published here, including The Orchid Thief and Rin Tin Tin. I've been at The New Yorker since 1992 when I became a staff writer. I had been to China previously on my honeymoon, so this has been a very, very different trip, which is a good thing, according to my husband. And it's certainly, that was 13 years ago. Obviously, I didn't come under the same circumstances, but it's been fascinating to feel the changes, and this has really been an education for me.
Hi, I'm Art Spiegelman. I'm a comics artist. I write, I draw, I do both together. Best known probably for a book called Mao's, a so-called graphic novel that got the Pulitzer Prize, a special Pulitzer, which I assume is like Special Olympics, but they did create a category for me at least. Then have done other books, like one about September 11th, since we lived a few blocks away from the towers, a book called In the Shadow of No Towers. And from 1992 to 2003, staff writer, artist, and editor for The New Yorker, where my wife still works as the cover editor and is traveling with me, Francoise Moli. I knew nothing about China. I don't even know how or why I came, but I was invited and couldn't resist. All I really knew was Chinatown, which is a few blocks from my house, and also the movie Chinatown, which seems even more appropriate and useful in terms of understanding this place. So as with Susan, this has been a real eye-opening educational thing, because I tended to be rather insular. I was aware of Occupy Central without reading every report that did come into The New Yorker. There too, but into the New York press. And even just finding out where Hong Kong is in relationship to Beijing was news to me.
Thank you for that honesty, Art. Let me ask you...
It's better to say it out front.
Yeah. Let me ask you, as you've had a chance at least a little bit to look online or look at the publications here, you may have noticed that there are some cartoons, but there's a dearth. And certainly cartoons, in light of what's happened at Charlie Hebdo, are very much in the press. So just if you could give a thought about any reaction you've had to cartoons you've seen, and also what role you think cartoon plays in the issues that we're talking about here in free expression.
Well, tomorrow I'll be a little wiser about cartoons, because we have meetings with two cartoonists, and I'll find out more. In terms of what I've seen online, or as I walked past what's left of the Tent City, it seems to have been a relatively minor player in shaping the thought and opinion here, even compared to the other visual arts. That there was sculpture, there's a lot of spontaneous eruptions that moved toward cartoon art, but it wasn't a significant player from what I've learned so far. So I'm not even sure to what degree there's really a cartoon tradition in Hong Kong. I know that for a while I was buying kind of kung fu comics in Chinatown just to see what was up. I'm hoping it's broader than that. But I would say it could play a far more intensive role, because cartooning has the ability to distill and focus, so that the history of useful cartoon images goes back a ways to at least Philippon and Daumier, and in England with Rowlandson and beyond. But even in America, the cartoon has been defanged. It's become almost as if it was an extension of the New Yorker gag cartoon. It's humor with political figures rather than just the psychiatrist and the couple sitting around together. And that's probably because cartoons can be so effective. Newspapers are incredibly wary of offending a reader anywhere, and cartoons seem to have a high capacity for giving offense when they're done well. They also have been historically rather significant. In America, Thomas Nast, back in the 19th century, was responsible for toppling a corrupt democratic machine, the Tweed Ring. And in fact, his caricatures were what helped catch and bring Boss Tweed to justice. They were acted as the wanted poster when he was just trying to fill a satchel with money and flee. The peculiar thing about looking out for free expression in China is it's the very week we left about 2 days after the Charlie Hebdo massacre took place, is that there's this other story that keeps tugging at me. And in beautiful free Hong Kong, I've been able to catch up on the internet news and see how that story's been going. Yahoo is a really terrible server, and Beijing was not as useful in finding out even what had happened after the initial events. There, I would say, since you brought up the Charlie Hebdo issues, it seems to me that I've been annoyed at how many American newspapers just wouldn't show the pictures out of a kind of, I can't figure out whether it's hypocrisy, fear, or a genuine delicacy of feeling that I can't enter into easily. But it seems to me that understanding the story involves seeing the images, and for newspapers not to print the images is to abdicate their power to the internet at a moment where the newspapers are actually under threat of being wiped out by that internet. So I was only able to give one or two interviews before I left Dodge and came here, but the overwhelming issue for me was that you can't protect free speech just as an abstraction saying, oh yes, they have the right to say it. It's the urgent notion that they have the right to say it without apology that has to be there as far as I'm concerned, because if you're not protecting the perimeters of free speech, you don't got free speech. What you've got is one degree of self-effacement or another. What's disturbed me in a little bit of news I've seen since is learning just yesterday or the day before, it's all a blur to me, a comedian in France being busted, well, a rather racist anti-Semitic comedian in France being busted for a Facebook post saying, "Je suis Charlie Chaboulet," identifying himself with the terrorist who shot up the kosher supermarket and killed his hostages, and that person's now facing enormous jail time and really high fines that have been doubled because it took place on Facebook and therefore is widely disseminated on the internet. And I just don't understand laws well enough to understand the distinctions between so-called hate crimes and what was done by Charlie Hebdo originally that precipitated all this, in that America has a different place where it sets the bar that has a lot to do with how imminent is the danger posed by the drawing or the writing. And as a result, I grew up thinking it was okay to march on Skokie, a Jewish neighborhood in Chicago where the Nazi party was marching, and it seemed to me as a disgusting as that was, it was really urgent that they be allowed to do it, and feel similarly about this creep in France.
Thank you very much for that, Art. I think one of the things your cartoonists will probably tell you tomorrow is that we used to have a much more active cartoon community, and in terms of published cartoons, and the number of papers that still have cartoonists has dwindled remarkably. So with that, I'm going...
One columnist said that the number of cartoonists killed in Paris is larger than the number of political cartoonists in the United States.
Interesting. I'm going to open this up to the audience, to anybody who has some questions about the report or the recommendations or observations. So please raise your hand. We will get a microphone to you somehow, if we have a waiter around with a microphone. There's a gentleman over here. Do we have a microphone? Do we have, it should be one there turned on. Can we get a microphone, please, and bring it to the person? There should be a waiter doing this, but I don't know what's happening. Okay, well, we'll come back to you.
Thank you. Peter Kennedy, University of Hong Kong. I don't know, maybe some of you have seen Albert Cheng's column today. Is Albert here? No?
No.
In any case, he canvasses some of the issues you've talked about, the firebombing of Jimmy Lai and so on. And to cut to the point, he says two things at the end of his article. The first is about the reaction of the pro-establishment forces in Hong Kong to these events. And he says, so far the police have failed to bring anyone to justice for the series of crimes. And then he talks about the lukewarm or lackluster response by the pro-establishment figures to these crimes. I don't know whether the panel would like to comment on that, or if anyone here is from the Don't Argue with Beijing party, perhaps you could also chip in. His second point is about the way in
but
which...
Can we just keep it to one question, and then we'll come back, and if you have a second one, we'll come around?
Well, they're both linked, so if you don't
please,
mind...
Please make it brief.
Yeah, I'm trying to. The second one is the divisions amongst journalists, that there should be journalistic solidarity on this, but there isn't. And maybe the panel can comment on that, and perhaps you as a journalist might suggest what could be done if this is indeed a true representation of things in Hong Kong.
Let me just say a word on the first point about accountability, because this is it's really one of the central themes of the report. And you'll see kind of anywhere in the world where you have infringements on free expression, it tends to be through these kind of shadowy hands. It's you know, there are places that will round up journalists and put them in jail, but there are many more places where journalists, you know, turn up injured and dead, and there is never any accounting for who is responsible. And that's often the way that governments sort of play it. They have people that do their business for them. And so this pattern, and we quote people in the report in the journalistic community who say, you know, it's sort of not seeing any reprisals, any accountability, any arrests or convictions that sends the message to all journalists that you're vulnerable and that nobody will help be held responsible if you are endangered. So I think that's one of the most important places of emphasis in terms of our recommendations and what's going to be necessary if we are to see this disturbing pattern reversed.
I'll just confine myself to your second point, which is, I think, a very valid one and a sort of somewhat sensitive one in this room in particular, which is I think that what tends to happen among us, among journalists, in a difficult situation like the one that pertains in Beijing at the moment, is that when you're waiting for visas and where certain people have their visas turned down, and you're all, I know, aware of the situation of the New York Times in particular in Beijing, is that the specter of self-censorship raises its head. And it's an uncomfortable one because none of us want to think that we're actually ever self-censoring, but there are many, many stories out there when we can't do them all and we're sort of establishing a hierarchy of needs. We have editors, etc. We work for, often for, newspapers and TV media outlets that have bigger business interests than just our story. And as I know a number of you here have had very personal experience with this, that what can tend to happen is that one does pull punches ultimately, or at least one is put in a position where one might pull punches. And I think that that's something that one really has to guard against, because it's sort of the beginning of a slippery slope in the honesty of coverage. And I think that that's, I mean, even in Hong Kong, in terms of the local media and the pressures that it's under, that's also a factor here.
This gentleman over here, please identify yourself.
My name is Dan Garrett. I'm a PhD student at City University of Hong Kong. I study China-Hong Kong relations and particularly protest culture. In Hong Kong, with freedom of the press, the most progressive media that is out there is the alternative media and the new media, which is not generally part of the mainstream. So my curiosity is how much you cover that, especially on the radical front, with publications like Civic Passion, and that's associated with more radical wings. With regards to cartoons and comics, actually, all three major occupation sites had an enormous number of cartoons and comics. In Hong Kong tradition, Kusol or Ergao tradition, mashup type internet stuff, it's really vibrant online. And several comics during Occupy were actually banned on the mainland. So certain artists like Kusun Lo, who has been very much in the radical wing, has done a lot of great graphic work pushing forward this. And this has become also banning. You will see this in a large protest. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, we do in the report, just to cover it to some degree, I mean, a couple of interesting things that we document. One case of online journalists being out there covering the protests and being told that they were not entitled to the same degree of access as mainstream journalists. So a lack of recognition of the police by police of the role of online media and citizen journalists, which is something not confined to Hong Kong. I mean, the boundaries of who is a journalist are kind of opening up and bleeding over, and that does raise some challenging issues for press freedom. Not everybody necessarily comes in with a press credential, so how do they identify themselves, and do they deserve or are they entitled to the same degree of access, and the law on that can differ. But this is a troubling pattern here of not recognizing the role of online media. And we do look at also the situation of House News, which I don't know if you would put that in the category that you're talking about, but the fact that that publication had been shut down, I understand it may be being brought back, which would be a promising development, but it's distressing to see some of the more provocative and challenging outlets coming under such pressure.
This gentleman right here, please.
Thank you. I'm Cherian George from Hong Kong Baptist University Department of Journalism. I'm glad Peter brought up the issue of cell censorship, which seems to be probably the most insidious form of media control in Hong Kong, as well as in many parts of Asia and the world. Specifically, the pressure brought by media owners to protect business interests, as you know. I couldn't find any recommendations specific to media owners, and I was wondering whether that was because you respect the rights of media owners to do whatever they want over the rights of the public to learn from journalists who do a story to tell, or is it just an admission there's nothing that can be done about it? Or just an oversight. It certainly is less sensational than the kinds of offences and violations that you do highlight, like attacks on journalists. But my guess is that, in fact, purely peaceful and non-violent intervention by media owners actually restricts the public's right to know much more than 18 attacks against journalists.
Well, I think it's an interesting point, and there may have been a way that we could have directed those recommendations. I think challenge a little bit is that you don't want to dictate, any particular kind of approach to media owners or editors. You can't insist that they enable any specific type of coverage. It's part of press freedom that they, do have the right to make those decisions. But I think the overall thrust of our recommendations in terms of recognizing what the press freedom obligations are and the ways that they're being impinged upon hopefully does send a message, because I think, you're absolutely right. Their role is critical. They're playing their cards very, very differently. They also, from what we've learned, have very different relationships to Hong Kong. Some of them are very hands-off. They're very far away. These newspapers are part of big empires that may not even be media empires. And so they're not really stakeholders in the same way that many of the people in this room are. And then you have other owners who are really, Jimmy Lai, really kind of on the front lines and paying the price in a profoundly personal way. So I think it was difficult to generalize, and we were conscious about kind of treading a line in terms of, telling owners or editors what to do. But, I think you raise a very valid point.
Sorry, if I can just add to that, I think obviously what we didn't want to do and have no right to do is to comment on the political direction of any particular paper. I mean, all papers have, you know, around the world. In a healthy, pluralistic media environment, what you hope to have is a whole spectrum of newspapers and media outlets representing a whole spectrum of views from right to left. I think the danger here is that you'll start to see media outlets bunching up really on one end of that spectrum because of the pressures that we've been talking about in the report.
In the back, there's a gentleman all the way back. In fact, there are two people back there, so we'll take them one at a time.
Yoichi Shimatsu, I'm with New America Media, correspondent, and I was a founding lecturer, faculty member of the journalism schools at the University of Hong Kong and Tsinghua University in Beijing. Following up on the Baptist University professor's comment, yeah, there was a circling of the wagons of the elites in Hong Kong, including the Western elites, the British Foreign Office and so on, which seemed to form a circle of wagons around the chief executive, C.Y. Leung. And despite a corruption scandal that involves them, that story seems to have just disappeared off the face of the earth, okay? So I don't think this is purely Beijing's handiwork. There's a kind of towering cowardice in this city among the elite. But my question is, I'm a little bit disturbed about how you valorize Jimmy Lai, because it was his payoffs through a phony foundation he created to the opposition parties that led for all of them to run for cover, and it left the students holding the bag. Okay, this protest was left, you know, it was basically gutted before it started. The students had to fight an uphill battle because of the corruption. Very strangely, it's usually the other way around. The political parties will bribe the press. In this case, the press bribes the political parties. So I think that has to be taken into account. I think the ICAC bust, how it was leaked, terrible violation of the law here. But I think the greater violation was a publisher like Jimmy Lai intervening so directly in the political process.
That's a statement, not a question. Can you put that in the form of a short question, please?
Yeah, I would like to see if you are going to address this problem of the Jimmy Lai case. It's much more complicated than it seems, so are you going to address this in a more well-rounded, balanced way?
Well, look, you know, our effort here really was to sort of collect this pattern of press freedom violations. I won't say that in relation to every single one, you know, we could get to the bottom of all of the shadowy forces that were at work. And, you know, in many cases there are, you know, from what I understand, very differing views about, you know, what led to what or what so-and-so did that may have been the real reason, behind what befell them. So it certainly is more complicated than we could in covering the breadth of what we tried to outline in the report, you know, delve into and truly get to the bottom of. So I won't claim that we've done that. But I still think the pattern stands. And, I'm sure it's the job of the Hong Kong Press Corps, really, to take on what it is that you're talking about. And I think, you know, the question is whether they will have the free range and the sense of confidence and security to do that. So we've tried to raise the issues, and we hope it will be a stimulus for more and more searching examination.
Are there more hands out there? Yes, Ching Chong out in the back.
My name is Ching Chong, six times from Singapore. People operate here are all well aware of the situation of the gradual erosion of press freedom. It is not what happened just a few days ago, but it is a process, a long process that they back to maybe after 1989. My problem is, with China getting stronger and stronger everywhere, being able to fund a lot of operations overseas, is there anything we could do about it? Even if we raise the problem to the United Nations, China's representative in the UN can try to block all sorts of discussions on Hong Kong. So we are left in a state of helplessness, in fact. We have been voicing this problem incessantly for the last at least 17 years, here in FCC as well. But every time we raise the problem, and every time there's no concerted response elsewhere. So I think we are really fighting a really bad uphill battle here.
Thank you. I mean, I would say, you know, and you asked the question of kind of what was surprising to us in Hong Kong. And for me, I think it's been pretty inspiring to be here and to hear from people of different age groups and different political affiliations and different sort of professions, whether it's artistic or literary or academic, you know, the courage that they have and the sense of mobilization and motivation that they have to defend and extend their freedom. So I think that is a pretty powerful foundation. And I can completely understand what you say, having spent the time that we did in Beijing and just what a closed, and confined environment it is, and what the situation is for journalists who are there. But I certainly would not give up. I think the world does recognize, and even China recognizes, what a unique and crucial role Hong Kong plays for so many different reasons. You know, some of them, you know, not entirely necessarily laudatory, but Hong Kong's important. And people will watch Hong Kong. You've also put Hong Kong much more on the agenda in a very powerful and vivid way. So I certainly don't think it's a lost cause on these issues.
Please wait for a microphone. This lady right over here, please.
Melissa Lee, Chinese University of Hong Kong. You mentioned meeting with different people during your time here in Hong Kong in order to make your report. I think Art mentioned meeting cartoonists tomorrow. I was wondering if you met with the Hong Kong Federation of Students during your time here.
The question not everybody may have been able to hear it was whether they met with the Hong Kong Federation of Students while here. Thank you.
Yes, we went with representatives. Can I? Well, I don't want to name names, but we had a great and really really fascinating and eye-opening discussion that kind of I think gave us a feel for the motivations at work, the determination at work, you know, the sense that this is an ongoing and long-term effort. I don't know if anyone wants to elaborate, but I think we have to be judicious in terms of not identifying people who met with us, because in many cases we did it just on the basis that the discussions were private.
Terry Nealon, if you have a microphone over here, please. To your right, Tony, right behind you.
Hi, I'm Terry Nealon. I'm presently a freelance journalist, but for many years I was a colleague with Francis on Radio Television Hong Kong.
My boss.
I think Suzanne's entirely correct in saying that Penn should not be naming names, but I think those of us who live here and are concerned should name names. And as far as I think I and many others are concerned, the greatest threat to press freedom here is a gentleman who lives a stone's throw away, C.Y. Leung, I think.
No question, just a comment. Okay. All right, this gentleman over here, please. No, take the microphone. This is going to be put on YouTube, and they will not be able to hear you.
Well, I'll certainly pull my punches like everyone else since we're on YouTube. I'm Jason Gleckman from the Chinese University of Hong Kong. I thought I would just ask Art and Suzanne, unless they don't want to talk on YouTube about this, if there were any occasions at the New Yorker over the past many years where punches were pulled or compromises may have had to have been made between journalistic optimism and the real world.
Thank you.
It's interesting that you asked that, because one of the themes that keeps coming up for us is the enormous glittering prize that China presents to the world and how distorting that is for decision making, and that American companies, I shouldn't say American, companies, corporations, and in some cases, media corporations can't resist the lure of the potential to deal with China, and that's probably the most disheartening fact, I think, that we kept coming across here, is how do you argue against that? In my experience as the New Yorker, one fact that I had never seen violated is the business side and the editorial side were completely isolated from each other. When I started at the magazine, the business offices were on a separate floor, and the business people were not allowed on the editorial floor. It was a little extreme, but it made the point that the editorial side needed to function with no connection to the business at all. The business side wasn't allowed to even know what stories we were working on. So that's an example of allowing the editorial side to function without regard to whether, I don't mean only the negative, that you're writing a story that could lose advertising. It works just as powerfully in the reverse, which is you're writing a story that could appeal to advertising. It works both ways. My experience, and I would say that over the years, that has really budged very little, that it's still, these things are very isolated. When you look at a marketplace like China and understand how gigantic the business side would be, it makes that isolation more and more challenging. And I would say, in short, I can't speak for every aspect of the New Yorker. I've been there a long time. In my experience, there has never been a moment where the heavy hand of the business department, let alone a political issue, but I don't write political stories, but there hasn't ever been a time where I felt constrained. I think if such a thing happened, we'd all hear about it. It would be a story that would end up coming out, because I think the New Yorker represents a kind of integrity, even with its moving from private ownership to being owned by a very large media company, that, you know, we run stories that ruffle feathers, and that has continued to be the case, and I hope it always will be.
A lot of what I was involved in at the New Yorker for the 10 years I was there was changing its DNA so that it would have covers that were more timely and would indeed ruffle feathers. And I would say never was there a problem from the business side or anything like that. What there is a kind of refinement that comes with the New Yorker that didn't come naturally to somebody who grew up with underground newspapers and making underground comics. So I was a weird experimental graft onto the New Yorker that opened things up in a way that I think are really healthy and are continued estimably by Françoise, of using the cover as a forum, because it's one of the only magazines left maybe anywhere outside of whatever's left of MAD, that has drawn images that aren't tied to a cover story or a celebrity, but anything from just the seasons to front page stories or other everywhere. And one of the things that was quite exhausting in the first rounds of this, where I think the first cover I did for the New Yorker, some of the older journalists may still remember, which was a kiss between a Hasidic man and a black woman that took place right after the Crown Heights riots in Brooklyn, race riots, really, in that place, bloodshed happening. And it was a cover of just two people kissing, and as if they could kiss and make up, the Hasidic Jew and this glamorous black woman. And what I found exhausting that round and ever after was defending an image after it was drawn to see if it could actually be published. But that has more to do with, I don't even know if it's self-censorship, but an image of oneself and what one's role is that was different for me coming from outside the New Yorker magazine's culture and what can be done from within it. I get now to look over my wife's shoulder at what she's going through. This past week, the cover of the week of the Charlie Hebdo massacres. There was a very elegant cover that actually manages to avoid too much sentiment, but stayed well within the proprieties of good taste. An Eiffel Tower coming out of blood with a red pencil point at its tip. Very different than what I would have done if I had been given free rein, but managed to avoid total maudlin use of the pencil image and make something that in its own way was quite moving. And I found that there were times where what I needed to do just couldn't find its way into the magazine in a way that I needed to make it. Like I mentioned in passing a book I did called In the Shadow of No Towers, where I was really only able to do it because, well, for one thing, the New Yorker wouldn't be interested in me doing repeated revisitings of September 11th for full pages for months and months thereafter. But when I sighed about it to a friend, Michael Naumann, who's the editor of Die Zeit, he said, fine, I'll give you as much space as you want and a no editor's clause. That was music to my ears and allowed me to do a page that made David Remnick do a double take that had a picture of me with George Bush with a gun to my head and Osama bin Laden with a machete to my neck as I sit at a drawing table trying to assess what had happened to me. And I said I felt equally threatened by both sides. This was not conventional wisdom at the time and was really going off in a moment where in America there was an incredible amount of self-muzzling going on so that the so-called liberal American press wouldn't be seen as unpatriotic. And therefore I was lucky to have what started with Die Zeit and became a coalition of the willing of papers in France, Italy, Argentina that really gave me free rein. And even though I really never wanted to be a political cartoonist per se, because I think of that category as a kind of art that has the shelf life of yogurt or something, only to be reused when somebody covers the teapot dome and tries to keep the student's interest by having a marginal illustration. But things felt so urgent to me at the time that it grew up in a way that some of the political writers and artists that we met in Beijing were bringing up, which is, I'm not a political artist, I'm just trying to breathe and write what's significant, what's affecting me, what's important to me, and sometimes that category genuinely is political.
First the gentleman, I saw his hand first, and then the lady right in front of you. Please wait for the microphone to your right.
Hello, I'm Iverson, a student journalist from Hong Kong Baptist University. I would like to adjust the focus to the right of student journalists covering major stories in Hong Kong. This is rather like personal experience, but I believe it is not an individual case. On the last day of covering the Occupy movement in Causeway Bay, I, as a student journalist from the English licensed magazine called The Young Reporter, I was rejected by the police to enter into the Occupy zone and the Pratt zone in order to get a closer view for taking photos. However, I have showed my student report, the reporter card, and it is a licensed magazine in Hong Kong, and they claim that they have got a list from PBRB, the Public Relations Bureau of the police, and they said that only mainstream media are allowed to cover and enter into the press zone. So how would you comment on this in relation to press freedom of Hong Kong?
Can I just take that question just for a second? Because the question of accreditation has come up in the Foreign Correspondents Club, and we've tried to discuss ways to deal with it. For those who don't know, and I think maybe the panelists are not aware because it's such a precise issue, we do not have a formal system of accreditation of the press in Hong Kong, nor have we wanted one. because if there were a central accreditation of the press, some people would get to be determined journalists and others would be not journalists. And who would do that? And we've long suspected, we think we know who would do it and how it would be done. So we've never wanted to have accreditation, but it poses a real problem because in situations like Occupy, in situations where there's unrest, the police have a job to do. You can't get around it. They can't let more people put themselves in harm's way. That's something that has to be done. And nor can they let everybody who puts up his hands and says, I'm a citizen journalist, you know, get up to the front of where something is happening in a situation, be it unrest or an accident, somebody in an ambulance, who knows, rubberneckers, people who just want to get in and see. They have a job to do. There is a public order responsibility that falls on the police. So this is always an area of some sort of tension between journalists everywhere, because our job is to be there as the eyes and ears of the people. That's why we get access. It's not because we're special people or born with a mark on our forehead. You know, we get this because we do a job for society. So there's a balancing act somewhere in there, and how to deal with that is an ongoing question for journalists in Hong Kong. But I support your general point, which is that the access to information is extremely important. We do not have an access to information law in Hong Kong. We don't have an archive law. And the issue of getting access to events is a live one. And I don't know exactly how we're going to address it, but you put your finger on an issue that's a very practical one, probably not easy to resolve, but it's a real issue. So that's from a local point of view. I turn it over to the people from the... from Penn.
I mean, this is also a subject that's not in any way confined to Hong Kong. I think what's happening, you know, the world over is that this kind of cloistered ranks of journalists who are accredited and recognized and whatever is breaking down. It's breaking down with new technology as more and more events, in effect, are reported on Twitter, on YouTube, on Facebook, that we're getting effectively eyewitness accounts of things as they happen by, you know, I wouldn't even call them citizen journalists. I'm not sure what that means. I mean, I think it's just people who are involved. I mean, you look at how it's changed the narrative of any of the big stories recently of, you know, reports coming out of places that are difficult to get to, like Syria and northern Iraq, of events like the two police brutality cases in the States recently, the Eric Garner case, the Ferguson case, where there've been cell phone videos that have really, you know, the whole story has revolved around them. We are finding at Penn, for example, that any sort of categorization of what a journalist is, indeed what a writer is and isn't, is becoming increasingly blurred. I mean, I agree in general that I think any system of accreditation is an invitation to be controlled. I mean, that's because it's, you know, who becomes the gatekeeper. It's these situations are always, you know, about who has control. I think it was in any system, as Stalin said of democracy, it's not who votes that counts, it's who counts the votes. I mean, whoever's in control of something, it decides on access. But it's becoming increasingly anarchic out there in good and bad ways. I think we've got a flow of information in general that we've never had. And I think more and more what a journalist's role is, and it's not just journalists, it's across sort of culture and media in general, is a curatorial role, that there's so much stuff out there that as a consumer, one has no idea what to believe, what not to believe. And so various organs, newspapers, whatever, you go to them to try and make sense of things because there's information overload and it's very difficult to want a voice that you can trust at least, or something that's been checked perhaps, because there's a lot of wild stuff out there. We're finding, for example, that more than 50% of our freedom to write cases, these are writers who end up in prison or in some other way persecuted for what they write, that more than 50% of these cases now, our caseload, are being persecuted, put in prison for things that have appeared online. The terminology changes from week to week. I wouldn't even, you know, blogging, what does blogging even mean anymore? I don't know. So it's, I think it's, it's a, you know, journalism, the whole trade, craft, profession, whatever you want to call it, of journalism, is at an enormous inflection point. I mean, you know, I'm not overly familiar with the economics of the media in Hong Kong, but certainly in England and in America and in the West generally, it's an extremely challenging time for journalists as one business model collapses, and we're in this sort of extended state of transition, and nobody quite knows where it ends up. This, exactly the same thing is happening for authors as well, as has happened, you know, before with musicians. And so it's both sort of fascinating and kind of bewildering at the same time.
The only little footnote I would add is that in the U.S., there is kind of a rising student press movement that is asserting its rights and advocating for itself. And I don't know to what extent student journalists here are connecting with those organizations like the Student Press Law Center, but it might be worth a look, particularly kind of given the chief executive's direct comments this week, which I think were pretty shocking to a lot of people in terms of singling out a student magazine, and then just the role of the student movement and its power. I think you can kind of perhaps derive some, you know, an extra measure of legitimacy in your own work because of the critical political role that students are playing here.
Can I just add one thing? Accreditation doesn't just keep people out. Accreditation lets people in. That's where the problem of balancing arises. So it is a difficult question. And one thing that would help, I think those of us who are in the local press would know that there's been a general deterioration, it has to be said, of the Police Public Relations Bureau and its relations with the press. It's for whatever reason, I don't know, that would be for those who run it to say, but it simply is not the same quality of relationship that one has known in past years. And I think that is also contributing to the problem. I don't blame the people who are in there. Some of them are very nice people who you can tell when you meet them want to be helpful, but something is happening systemically. And I think that's something that the government could address to everyone's benefit. Before we give repeat questions, I want to be sure that everybody who hasn't asked one yet has a chance. In the back.
Hi, my name is Ina Cho, journalist and FCC member. I'm just wondering, has the thought ever occurred to Penn that given Beijing's and CY Leung's government's repeated warning against foreign interference, that this report is going to do damage?
Well, let me take part of this which was not in your question, and then throw it open. I mean, I think that the specter of kind of the hidden foreign hand behind anything is something that you come across increasingly in China generally. I think that anything that's unpopular, there's always a hunt for foreign funding or some foreign element to it, that it's a kind of imperialist thing. It's something, you know, even the idea sometimes put forward to us in China that freedom of expression is a peculiarly Western idea, that it's not a universal right at all, and that this is something that that in itself is a kind of an act of cultural imperialism. I mean, I think that one of our abiding concerns when we were in Beijing is that we felt that we had to operate under a literary Hippocratic oath, which was that first do no harm in the people that we saw and things. What we didn't want to do is blunder in as well-intentioned foreigners and kind of leave a trail of disaster behind us as people got kind of picked up and dragged off and whatever, and we went away sort of self-congratulatory that we'd sort of checked the temperature on China and we'd sort of caused more chaos and disaster than before, thanks for nothing. So we were very, very respectful of the fears of people, of writers, beleaguered writers in Beijing. And believe me, they, you know, we haven't really discussed that, but it did feel after a week there that a lot of these independent critical writers are, that their position has deteriorated really markedly, you know, in the last 18 months, 2 years, but particularly in the last 6 months. It's just the pace of what's happening to them has really picked up. That there aren't even, with the best will in the world, the rules of engagement are no longer clear. You know, there used to be these sort of very relatively clear third rail, certain topics that if you discussed in a certain way, you sort of knew what was going to happen to you. That's all suddenly fluid again. Nobody quite knows what the rules are. Some people seem to get away with more than others. Some people can, you know, seem to manage in certain mediums and not in others. It's a very, very confused situation for writers trying to navigate it. You know, but I have to say, so for us coming to Hong Kong after having been in Beijing for a week, these things are all about perspective. Having come from Beijing, we came to Hong Kong and it seems like a kind of bastion of freedom and openness. We want to sort of dance in the street. But obviously, if your perspective is what Hong Kong has been like in the past, you know, that's a different and completely, accurate perspective. But I did notice, I mean, with some... You know, I noticed that in our report, you know, on the page, you know, talking about the framework and methodology, there's a little paragraph at the end which says most of the journalists interviewed, both foreign correspondents and local journalists writing in Chinese or English, requested to remain anonymous due to fear of professional repercussions. So, you know, it is. I think that there is a danger. There's always a danger here that as foreigners. That you're perceived as as part of a conspiracy. There's a very paranoid atmosphere in Beijing at the moment. I mean, it's a very bizarre. To us, it felt like a very bizarre atmosphere there at the moment, with a lot of the tone of the remarks about the West in particular and Japan, my goodness me, the rhetoric against Japan is kind of eye-watering, I must say, that sort of belies China's economic growth and everything. It seems odd that one would understand it more obviously in the case of, for example, Russia, where you've got an economy that's in free fall, you know, oil prices have gone down. It's in that kind of situation, you sort of understand the rationale of Putin becoming ultra-nationalistic and lashing out at foreign foes and seeing the hidden hand of America or whatever behind everything that's gone wrong. It's less understandable, it seems to me, in the case of Beijing, but it's certainly present.
Just to add one thing to what Peter has said, which is, I do think, as we sort of look at Penn, at kind of how we make change and how we defend free expression worldwide, I think the most valuable assets that we have as an organization are those Penn centers operating on the ground in the places where free expression is most challenged. And, you know, we're one of them with respect to the United States, and we take our U.S. work very seriously, because we're well positioned to hold the U.S. government accountable. We can mobilize really influential writers in real time to speak out on issues like surveillance or the subpoena of James Risen, the New York Times reporter, who was nearly compelled to reveal his sources. So we've not had a strong Penn presence here in Hong Kong, and I think it's something that if it were there as a voice, and you know, every center around the world, we're a very decentralized organization. So when there is a Penn Center active on the ground, it's really because local writers are motivated to come together behind Penn's mission. And I'll give one example in the region, which is Myanmar, where we had obviously an incredibly closed environment, and one thing we do in New York is we give an award every year to a writer who's in jail. And over the years, two of those writers were from Myanmar, and when they were released from jail and when the reforms began to happen, they came together to form Myanmar Penn, and that's now become a thriving organization that is holding the government accountable with respect to freedom. And we see some worrisome backsliding there. Obviously, things are dramatically improved in terms of censorship and the environment for press, but it's not a free ride, and it's very important to hold the government accountable as it moves through the transition and the elections later this year. And PEN Myanmar is doing that, and we partner. So they come to Washington, and they put pressure, help us put pressure on the Obama administration to use the leverage that they have on Tin Shan to uphold his obligations. So I think you're raising an important point, which is that most often the most influential and credible voice is a voice from the ground.
I'll go back if you've got a short question over there. There's one person. Oh, can we go afterwards, please? We'll pass the mic over. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, Dan Garrett, City University. Has the report looked at non-media, non-verbal expression in literature, specifically graphic, visual expression in literature, specifically related to the instance of graffiti and street art that is political? 2011, we had Who's Afraid of Ai Weiwei. Now we have graffiti on the ICAC against CY Long. But what media did not talk about, there's also the Mockingjay symbol for uprising as well, which has been populated throughout the city in different of the occupation zones. So you have a lot of political graffiti emerging now. Also, museums refused to take Occupy art to save it as a historical thing. This follows refusal or the pressure against the 4 June Museum to set up in Hong Kong. So this is also another type of visual expression. And this follows along. Did you also look at...
I'm gonna call it there. Yeah. I think you can write your thesis later.
So online expression is related to that article, the online Article 23 issue.
We don't address those issues in the report, although we have heard about them in the meetings that we've been having around town. There's a questioner in the second row who's been waiting patiently.
The gentleman over here is the one I saw next. Then we'll come back over here. And on the question of graffiti, I'm going to intervene for one thing. Many foreigners, never in all their years here, walk inside a housing estate in Hong Kong. I suggest that you make an effort to do that, because if you want to see graffiti sometime, go inside the estates, especially the older ones, and look in the hallways. You'll see what's interior discussion and not exterior discussion.
My name is Peter Berthold. I'm a citizen of Hong Kong, not a writer, not a journalist, obviously. I'm on the other side. I'm a consumer of news. And I would like to know from you whether you found any restrictions with regard to access to news. I travel quite a lot in the world, and I can tell you, I live here for 33 years. Nowhere do I have better access to international newspapers, media, information than in Hong Kong.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, what you reflect is sort of, Hong Kong's role as this incredibly cosmopolitan global center and a hub for access to information and insight about the region and a point of connection between the whole world and this region. But we do document some problems in that respect, principally the cyber attacks taking down influential websites and news websites at critical times, and then the issues in relation to the distribution of Apple Daily and the protests blocking the distribution of the newspaper, incidents of soy sauce being poured all over newspapers to destroy newspapers. So I would say, not at the level that would interfere with the overall sense that news here is very, very widely available, but still some troubling incidents, particularly in terms of cyber interference.
This very patient lady here, please identify yourself.
Thank you. I'm Joyce from Harmony Magazine, and I have a question for Mr. Spiegelman. As a cartoonist, do you see the need to strike a balance between making a statement through caricature or exposing or focalizing a contradiction through caricature and respecting the religious sensibility or political sensibility of other communities? Thank you.
Well, like I was saying before, I'm not that good at the respect thing. so I just admire the cartoon's ability to move that far into the brain as quickly as it does. And it involves playing with dynamite. The source of most cartoon imagery is the stereotype. It's the cartoon language that one works with. It's literally the alphabet. When you try to become a cartoonist, you have to either distill by copying other cartoons or find a How to Draw Cartoons manual. And in the manuals, you'd learn which marks make an ear, and you'd learn which marks make a kike, a nigger, a spick, and so on. It takes a lot of sophistication, I think, to deal with those things in ways that don't reinforce the stereotype. And I would say Mao's was an example of using the racial stereotypes that were applicable in World War II and turning them against themselves. Jews were considered rodents. The killing gas in Auschwitz was Zyklon B, a pesticide. And trying to make these pests stand up and hold out for their own humanity is an important aspect of that book, Mao's. So I believe, I think I said this earlier, that unless one defends the perimeter, one doesn't have a center. And I don't know that I would always have moved in the directions of Charlie Hebdo, but I admired its mission as equal opportunity offenders. So within that, I don't think there's that much else to say. I would answer to your point earlier that to the degree that Penn is covering this, I thought it was astonishing that I was invited to come along. And yet, it seemed like a prescient choice after I'm on a plane to China 48 hours after the Paris thing. So, yeah, I've been taking snapshots of graffiti wherever I've seen it. I find, without having been able to get inside the housing council buildings or whatever they are, that it's astonishing how little there is here that you just see as you pass on the street. I was, and Francoise both, were very amused by seeing the photo of the Great Wall of Post-its that were part of Occupy as the world's most polite graffiti. Please.
Okay, is there anyone else who I've overlooked? It's when you look out in the audience from up here and the lights are in your face, it kind of turns into a slightly dark, muddled mass out there, so I don't always see the hands. Enid, you'll get a second turn.
Sorry, I'll keep this very, very short, and it's a follow-up to this lady's question. As a cartoonist, do you think that you should target the powerful more so than the powerless?
Back in 2006, Harper's Magazine gave me a chance to write about the Gillens Post in cartoons, and I think I formulated it for myself then, which is it's important to talk truth to power, but it's also, as I said, important to defend the perimeters of that power of expression, but that it's much more elegant to make a cartoon that doesn't afflict the afflicted. I would say about that Harper's thing, just as long as we have the minute to do it, I was impressed that I was invited to do whatever I wanted by Harper's, and it included printing the cartoons at a moment that still felt a bit risky. I thought it was important to see all 12 cartoons, not the hot-headed prophet in a bomb turban only as the icon of this thing, because in order to understand what was going on, it wasn't possible to just dismiss these as all insignificant cartoons. There was a spectrum of opinion expressed in a newspaper whose real purpose, I believe, was to afflict the afflicted. The local Danish immigrant population was vulnerable to this kind of baiting that the Gillens Posten seemed to be precipitating. And within that, the spectrum of drawings was interesting because some of them were specifically not dealing with Mohammed, but dealing with the damned editors of the Gillens Post as a racist baiting machine. Some of them were just about cartoonists being afraid to say anything. So seeing them was very useful. I ended up showing all 12 cartoons, discussing them a little bit, and gave them between 1 and 4 fatwa bombs, but from the point of view of a secular cartoonist, trying to see which ones were coherently presenting their point of view and which ones were just confused art, which deserved the 4-star, or the 4-bomb review. If I can hold you for one more second on that, I'll just say that the only editing I got as interference was the cover. Was the cover story. It was called Drawing Blood, a drawing table with racial and religious and all kinds of stereotypes, including a featured spot for the prophet copied from one of the cartoons in the paper. And then I was told by the editor, we have a problem with this cover. And I went, really? Which one? Is it the gay priest or the spick or the... and then what there was just to fill out a corner of the layout. I had a little, the kind of doodle I would make in my notebooks when I was a school kid of a naked woman's torso. And they said, that's going to be a problem for us. And I said, really? I said, yeah, well, we're not going to get on newsstands in Canada if there's a woman's breasts on the cover. So is it okay if just on the Canadian issue we put a bar across her privates? And I just said that was the best editing I ever had, and we would do it on all the issues. And even with that, I was censored in Canada to a degree, and the chapter's Indigo News Chain, a rather powerful bookstore distribution system, wouldn't carry that issue of Harper's, which of course made it sell better than any other 20th century issue of Harper's.
Just before I go to the next, there was a question. When I was a kid, if you wanted to make a movie draw in patrons, or you wanted to sell a book, you slapped Band in Boston on the cover. And everybody knew in those days that Boston was a very puritanical place and under the influence of the cardinal. So it sometimes works both ways. Liz Bosher, I think you have a question. Would you wait for a microphone, please?
Hi, I'm Liz Bosher. I was a civil servant in this town for many years, but I'm currently a member of the Hong Kong 2020 pro-democracy think tank, and I believe you've met Mrs. Chan yesterday, who's the convener of that. I guess journalism isn't a very well-paid profession anywhere, but you may have realized when you come here that there are a lot of young journalists here who are paid an absolute pittance. Career prospects are not very promising for them. I just wondered if you had, I don't know, maybe any advice or any thoughts coming from your backgrounds as to how you can raise the profile of journalism and to really encourage young people to look upon it as a good profession and something that they can make their life's career.
Well, let me take this. I've taught writing and journalism at various places and in seminar form. And at the beginning, my first seminar, basically, I try and persuade them not to do it. Insofar as, I mean, you've got to go in with both eyes open. And as I alluded to before, I think there is a crisis in the profession generally. There really is, as there is with writers. I mean, we've just had this whole situation with Amazon in America. I don't know if any of you followed it here. The big dispute between Amazon and the publishers, and one thing and another. And there's Amazon is about to launch the equivalent, I think it's called Amazon Unlimited, which is an equivalent of Spotify, where for a certain sum of money, a small sum of money, you can download unlimited books, you know, the money you pay per month. And that will also have a huge impact on especially mid-list authors, which mid-list authors represent 99.9% of the literary profession. I think it's a real challenge, and I think that, you know, not to downgrade anything that we've been talking about hitherto, but it represents an existential challenge to the media in some ways if it ceases to be a profession that a young, talented university student or whatever can go into, can train for and go into and have, you know, anticipate a proper career with a career arc. And, you know, and at the moment, it's very, very difficult to do that, not just in, and I mean, I'm sad to say, not just in Hong Kong by any means, but really absolutely everywhere. Now, I think we're in a period of transition, but... It seems to have gone on for quite a long time, and I think that at a certain point, the real problem with almost all the magazines and newspapers that I've been working for, been affiliated with in one way or another, is that the so-called legacy publications, the ones that have a print arm and have been in print, they either start to cannibalize themselves by putting themselves on the web, not behind a paywall, and hope that there's some advertising change that comes in. And then what tends to happen, I can't think of a single case where this really hasn't happened, is that they start to erode their own print editions. That's just what happens, even if it's a selection of things online, not the whole thing, whatever. There's various different models. When they go behind paywalls, the traffic shrinks enormously. And so at the moment, I'm not sure. You know, there's lots of people with far greater resources than ours thinking about ways to get around it. But I think it's something that we're probably going to be in. It's a stage we're going to be in for at least the next 3 to 5 years before we find some kind of model that's sustainable. I do, however, think the bright point is that, you know, there's a difference between information and knowledge. I mean, there is a curatorial aspect to this, that what you have is information overload, but it's unguided, it's unprocessed, you don't know what to believe. There's an awful lot of stuff out there that is, you know, completely speculative or just plain wrong, or you know, that you've no idea whether it's true or not, and that eventually there will continue to be a demand for books and magazines and literature in general, journalism. There will, but how to do it and have a decent profession is something that I think we've still got 3 to 5 years to figure out how that works. Susan.
Pass down the mic.
I think, just to repeat what Peter's saying, this is not only a universal question, I also think it's a permanent question. I don't think that 50 years ago journalists felt well paid and secure. I think it's the nature of the profession. It is in transition. The security of jobs that might have been available at newspapers is in total upheaval. I had a fellowship at Harvard a few years ago, and it's amazing to me the number of those people who have left journalism. It's sort of discouraging. And yet, I also have this optimistic feeling that people have always been drawn to it, never for the reason of it being a high-paying job. And I think this period of transition is going to shake out. It has to, where while the traditional journalism jobs may be shrinking or disappearing, excuse me, something else will emerge. Just to give you an example of why I do feel that we're sort of hitting the plateau is when the worst of the kind of media shakeout was happening, there was a Twitter account called "The Media is Dying," which for totally self-punishing reasons I followed avidly. And it would post every day which newspaper had closed, who had laid people off, and it was like watching a car wreck, and I couldn't tear my eyes away. Interestingly, the pace of those layoffs and newspaper shutdowns has stalled enough that the account is suspended. So I think of that as being a little bit heartening. It hasn't been replaced with a Twitter account called "The Media is Growing or Expanding," but at least that particular account has shut down. I just think that journalists as a lot are whiners and grouches and complainers, and that's who we are, and we will always feel underpaid and underappreciated. And it will ebb and flow depending on what the media environment is. But I think it would be scary to me to come back here in 10 years and have no one raise that question. I would think, what's wrong with us that we're not worrying about our profession? We ought to be all the time.
Uh, every place has its own context. And I take your point, but I would just add that for local journalists in Hong Kong, would be aware that somebody who's entering the profession here right now, fresh out of school with a journalism bachelor's degree or whatever, is probably getting something in the vicinity of $1,000 Hong Kong a month or so more than what cub reporters were being paid when I arrived in Hong Kong exactly 25 years ago. So I think that for us, it's really stalled. And for people who enjoy putting things up online and not worrying about being paid for it, I hope you have a personal trust fund that you've inherited from your parents or someplace. But also realize that this flow of information which media owners can now use comes to them free or at very little cost. Because the competition of people who just want to get their name out there or get something published is so great that it completely undercuts the market. I mean, in addition to the demise of publications that you talked about, there's also been a really big erosion of the unions that represented journalists in the past, because you don't have the big publications anymore that paid decent salaries. And there we have. But that's a different subject, I think, than the study that we are, the report that we're here for today. I'm going to wrap this up in a minute, unless I have any question or comment from anyone in our audience. Yeah, we have one person over here. Microphone, please. This gentleman up in front with the standing up.
Excuse me. Hello, my name's Nathaniel. I'm a student reporter from Hong Kong Baptist University, obviously some who doesn't have a promising future. My question to the panel is that one of the excuses the Hong Kong government and police are using to undermine press freedom in Hong Kong is the fact that some journalists do have political affiliation to radical local, you know, political parties. For example, if, I don't know if you've heard of them, the Passion Times or the local press. So they are therefore banned from accessing to the, you know, frontline scene in the Occupy, during the Occupy movement. So do you think then, radical, you know, political party members who identify themselves as journalists will, you know, will be an issue to traditional journalism?
I think that can be and is an issue everywhere, that you have you know, members of the press that play very different roles, that are there with very different agendas, and you know, that's part of the way the system should work, that there's a great diversity of views, and that you know, the audience plays a role in sorting through those views and looking at different indicia of credibility and seriousness in terms of weighing out many different sources of information. I think that's only exploded online. I mean, one, you know, there are now all these websites that sort of have truth in the title, and somebody said to me, you know, if it's Truth Out or Truth Dig, that, you know, you can be sure it's not the truth. And so it becomes very hard to know what sources are credible, and I think we've all had to become a lot more sophisticated. And in some ways, it's strengthened the role of the strongest news brands in the world that are seen to uphold, you know, what Susan was talking about earlier in terms of very high standards of objectivity, ensuring that, you know, whether it's political or commercial agendas, that they're kept at bay, and that's part of what helps to sustain the audience for some of the most important and credible news brands around the world. But, you know, I would be very wary of that argument when it comes from people in positions of political power. You know, it's a way of trying to discredit the whole on the basis of, you know, the biases or the foibles of the few, and it should never be taken as an argument or a justification to constrict press freedom. Generally, those outlets have their role, you know, and the answer, if they're, what they're promoting or putting out there is not credible or not truthful, the answer is rebutting it through more expression from more credible outlets, from outlets with a different political point of view or a different agenda. The answer is not to shut them down, much less use that as a justification for shutting everybody down.
I mean, mean, there has been, you know, there is, I think Francis brought this point up earlier, for example, you know, in the States, if you want to get into the White House press briefing, you can't, I mean, there's only a certain amount of room, and when, you know, who gets accreditation and who doesn't, these situations exist. I mean, and there was an issue recently where online publications started getting correspondents in there for the first time, that they were seen as being, you know, that they needed a seat at the table. And it is a big, if somewhat unruly, family. I mean, there should be a spectrum of things. We have, you know, there are outlets in any, even in environments we consider to be very free media environments, which by and large the American one is, where you know what you're getting. If you're watching Fox News, you understand what you're seeing. You know, and in England, if you're reading The Guardian or The Telegraph or whatever, you know, you understand as a consumer. The consumers are educated enough to understand what they're seeing, and that you can push that right over to the far left and to the far right. And, you know, it always amused me as someone coming from the Anglo tradition, arriving in America, where, you know, in England, that was the way you did it. You had newspapers that sort of, in a sense, carried their opinions, you know, on their sleeves to some extent. But you could choose, and you could take a paper from the right and the left and read them and see their various takes. In America, there was a more earnest striving for a sort of objectivity. I mean, I always feel very... I always distrust the idea of objectivity in the sense that I think it just doesn't exist. I mean, none of us are really objective about anything. I do think that there's a concept of fairness where, you know, if you accuse somebody of something, they get to answer and that kind of thing. Where in a story and I think that's what journalistic professionalism is about. And stories where you can see it's a stitch up, you can sort of see it. And I think also, you know, that's what consumers bring to the table. Someone earlier mentioned, you know, being a representative of, you know, we're also all of us readers, and that you bring your own critical faculties to things that you read, and you can usually tell, you know, when things are coming from a particular point of view.
I don't want to be guilty of imposing censorship or triggering anarchy, but we are reaching the point where our patient staff must start rearranging this room for other uses this evening. So with that, I want to thank all of you for coming. Everybody stayed. Nobody's walked out, which is remarkable. And no protests and no shouting and shaking of fists and no umbrellas in the room. So I think on the whole, I'd like to thank everybody from Penn who has been here, Peter, Suzanne, Art, and Susan. And thank you all for coming. And I think if you have a few questions to pose to individuals, I think they'll stick around for a bit to answer some in the hallway. So thank you all, and we'll see you again soon. Thank you.